And welcome everyone to another very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and today I am joined with Tim Fugali, who is another one of our contributors at Podcasting Them Softly. Frank was unavailable, and Tim has so graciously stepped into the hot seat and joining us today for a chat. A second chat, actually, is returning guest film editor Mick Audsley. His film Allied opened a few weeks ago. He recently co-cut with Jeremiah Driscoll for Robert Zemeckis, and hopefully everyone's gotten a chance to check it out. And today we're going to sort of bounce around Mick's amazing filmography and talk about some of the movies that we didn't get a chance to cover on the first time, because he does happen to have a lot of varied credits spanning genres and years. So welcome back to the show, Mick. Thank you so much for coming back to chat.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you. And, you know, greetings from London.
Very cool. Yeah, we got the international call going today. So I think one of the things that one of the movies I really wanted to talk a little bit more in depth, I know we touched upon it the first time around, but it's actually a movie that, if I'm not mistaken, you had a little bit more to do than just edit, which was Dirty Pretty Things.
Oh, yeah.
Just a huge, huge fan of this film. I mean, and it's like, it's so underrated. If people, you know, the listeners out there, if you're not familiar with Dirty Pretty Things, it's in a very original, unique sort of thriller. It touches on, you know, immigration, and it touches on noir. Shaibul Talaijafor and Audrey Tautou star, and they're sort of these two disparate souls that are working in a seedy hotel, and they come across the beginnings of what seems to be illegal organ donor trade, the black market.
That's right. It's the black market in return for legitimacy passports in order to either stay in Britain legitimately and work above, you know, not under the scrutiny of immigration control, or indeed emigrate somewhere else, America or wherever. I mean, I think it's funny because I think, I'm trying to remember when the film was made, it's probably 12 to 13, 14 years ago. I'm afraid I can't exactly remember the date we made that, but
it's back in 2002.
2002. Oh, okay, 2002. Okay, 14 years. So it's interesting that Steve Knight, who wrote it, has touched upon a subject which is now, for all of us, you know, you guys in America and us here in Britain and indeed in Europe, everywhere, that the issues that that film raised are now as pertinent as before, if not more so. And what's interesting about the movie, I believe, is that it sort of exposes a world where you suddenly can look at the world that we know, certainly in London here, and see it through different eyes. It kind of shows you an underworld or an underbelly of a world that we all know about, and how reliant we are on workers coming in, and often in this case doing jobs that the residents, workers, are unwilling to do. It's a fascinating film in that respect, and I was lucky not only to edit it but also to have a chance to do some of the second unit directing of shots that I needed to complete the cut, you know, courtesy of my good friend Stephen Breers, who gave me a few days to do the second unit shooting, which was a great privilege.
Because a lot of people will, you know, there's a lot of people that do watch credits, and they might not know everything, what everybody does, and invariably you always see the big, you know, text crawl, second unit, you know, and all these various names and people doing. Tell people what, just in case they don't know, what second unit entails and what that means.
Yeah, well, generally, it involves getting out there and shooting shots which are generally hardware, if you know what I mean. They generally don't involve cast members. So it might be clocks. In the case of this film, it was clocks, telephones, you know, bits of gear like that, inserts, which are, if you like, not involving the leading actors. They're the details often that you need to support sequence, actually, in this case, I was fortunate that I was given Chiwetel and a big piece of set and so on in order to do the shots that we needed to support some of the sequences, the details. Because, you know, a director's shooting with a big cast and so on, time flies by, and doing a shot of a telephone being picked up may not be the most important thing in their working day, but it's an important element in the storytelling in the editorial department, and ultimately for the director's cut, you know. So that can be subcontracted to perhaps another director, a second unit director, or as it used to be, you know, editors who, as I had done with this film, was to draw out the shots that I needed to complete the sequences, shots generally that excluded the cast. So we call them cheap shots. I don't think they are, but if you know what I mean. So in this case, there was a sequence where I needed a very sort of controlled vocabulary to tell a time story, with clocks being advancing in, through the sequence, or television screens, or CCTV, things like that. So I would, as I was assembling the sequences while we were shooting, I would draw up a list of the shots and angles that I needed, and ultimately I was given 2 or 3 days and a director of photography to shoot those pieces and insert them into the movie. So it was great, a great privilege. It can be simple things like a train going by or a car going by, you know, the sort of thing that doesn't necessarily involve the cast, but they are important shots, and they are important in the grammar of the movie. It was a great privilege.
And it was another chance, again, like you mentioned, for you to collaborate with Stephen Frears.
That's right. And he had also the wonderful Chris Menges, his long-term collaborator as a DOP, who did an absolutely beautiful job shooting that film and giving it the look that, if any of you return to it, will appreciate as much as I do. It's got a fantastic atmosphere and look photographically. It's really amazing. So all in all, I think everybody sort of excelled, and it was interesting that the connection being that Steve Knight, who wrote it, also was the writer for Allied. So that brought two parts of my life back together again that spanned 14 years.
and that's it too, is that Steve Knight has also become a very prolific writer in the time since, I know he was before, but he's become a very go-to guy for studios and for his own work.
Very much so, very much so, as I understand it. I keep running into people who say, I'm working on a film that Steve's written. I go, wow, there's another one. He's got a lot of them in his back pocket, so I'm delighted, because it's quality stuff.
And that film, and in particular, Dirty Pretty Things, is one of those movies that, you know, it just feels so resolutely un-Hollywood, and it just feels so, it feels like the kind of movie that could only have been made in Europe with a European sensibility, in my mind. It's tough subject matter, and it sort of straddles genres. It's not really one thing, per se. And I think we touched on that a little bit on our first chat about how, you know, you're a fan of narratives, I think, that juggle tone and, you know, are kind of up to a couple of things at once.
Absolutely. I mean, interestingly, of course, if my memory serves me well, that was a co-production between our BBC films here and also Harvey Weinstein. So we can thank you know, the United States in that way for helping support and make what feels, I know what you're saying, it feels like a European movie
I've been very critical of Harvey Weinstein's antics of late with burying certain movies, but if he was responsible for putting up any money to get that movie made, then I will give him some credit, certainly, because that movie is very cool, and it doesn't feel like something that any major studio or studio executive would probably be like, yeah, let's make a very dark thriller with very morally sort of not
conflicting.
Yeah, just very interesting characters. I mean, there's nothing really black or white about the film and the people that inhabit that world. So I'm glad to hear. I guess I'm just don't remember that he has something to do with that, which is great.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's perhaps important to say that certainly as British filmmakers here, there's I haven't worked with them for some time, but certainly there was a period before Dirty Pretty Things and up to and including where we here were extremely reliant or grateful to Harvey's the Weinstein support for filmmaking, you know, here in Britain. It really is very significant what they did to support films, quirky perhaps or slightly more offbeat films and European films. So I always feel it should be said, you know, noted that without that support, a lot of things wouldn't have emerged from here, that most certainly in my view.
That's interesting. Nick, I was going to ask you, Harvey has a bit of a reputation for invading the editing suite.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if he had a bit of a stronger hand on that project than maybe some of the other ones you were involved with.
Certainly no. He was always very respectful of us, and I've known him for many years, actually, since the Grifters, which I think he tried to purchase in the early days. But no, well, certainly in my experience, I think one has to be open to listening to what people say, you know, in his position, listening to what their worries and concerns are, because normally or very often that sort of involvement or producership always does generally produce a better film, in my view. It opens up a debate. It might be that you don't agree with their view of it, but in the end, kicking it around always, in my experience, in the end, it might be a tough ride on the way, but in the end, it gets better work, and one should always listen. You don't have to literally take what's being told you, but it's always good to be open and listen to what people's thoughts and concerns are. I mean, I know Harvey does have a reputation for wanting to reshape films, certainly in the editorial stages. That hasn't happened to me directly or in a way which I thought was detrimental to the movie ultimately. But, you know, maybe I've just been fortunate in that respect. But I've got a lot of time for his view of things. He has an innate understanding of movies and an innate understanding of narrative. So we here as British filmmakers, I think, would have been very, very, would have suffered greatly without his involvement, certainly over the last, 20 years or so.
Interesting.
And sort of just to follow up on that, and my guess is that every filmmaker is different, every project is different.
Absolutely.
Are you a fan of being given a series of directions by a filmmaker and then them letting you do the editing yourself, or are you more of a fan of collaborating in the edit suite with a director who's sitting with you at the Avid or at your control center or whatever you want to call it these days?
Movie over.
It's not like editing on violas anymore, but are you a fan of the collaborative process in the editing suite, or are you somebody that's just like, all right, I know what I have to get done, let me do it, and then let me show it to the filmmaker?
I think, Nick, it varies from director to director. It's always collaborative, whether they are with you every hour of your working day after shooting, let's say, or not. It's a collaborative process, and in effect, for me, it's why I enjoy the job, is having a discussion, a debate. Doing something entirely on your own is a lonely business, especially if it involves the process of making things which are an experience and demand people's responses, like the cinema, music and sound and picture. They invoke responses, and I think having a collaborative discussion through the process, certainly of editorial feature filmmaking, is the great joy of it. You have to be prepared to often do things which you know perhaps ultimately are going to be not useful, but they generally, like I was saying about Harvey, generally any form of discussion or opinion forwards you in some way, even if it just helps galvanize your own view of what you're doing. For me, the directors I've worked with have been incredibly generous and given me a lot of free rein if I want it, or indeed, you know, do you mind if I sit with you? I don't really mind with if they're with me every hour or not. You know, I've got to carry on doing the work. Generally, it works best if we have kind of a relay race, and I run with the baton for a bit and then hand it to them for their contribution and comments, and then they follow their instincts and so on, and I comment on that. And it's a sort of seesaw. And, you know, that's, for me, the pleasure of it. You kind of jog along together and use each other's energy to forward the film and have this ongoing, you know, exciting discussion about what will make the film better, what will improve it, what do we need to see, what do we leave out, what performances do we like, what performances don't we need, so on and so on. So knowing this, it really comes from the top, that if you as an editor feel secure that ultimately the authority must, in our job, lie with the director, then provided you kind of leave your ego to one side to a degree, ultimately, and give to the whole, and give to them, give to the whole thing. Yeah, ultimately, for my own part, I've had an enormous amount of freedom and been very happy, and I look at the films and think, well, that was certainly the best I could do for them and with them. And you actually, by letting go in some way, you end up possessing it more. It's an odd thing. I that's a little weird, I know, to say, but letting go and being open to everything, somehow you then make something which you process and becomes very much your own. The hard thing is finishing a film and saying goodbye to it. So it's a bit like saying goodbye to a very close friend for a long time. You've lived with it for a long time, and then you have to say goodbye and never see it again. That's the way it works.
Yeah. No, that is something that I've actually, I mean, I'm not a filmmaker, but I have thought about what that must be like, you know, especially on films that last a year, 2 years, some of these, you know, not that a smaller film can't have that much of an emotional impact on you, but as a person, but some of these films where there's, you know, 1,000 people working on them and there's all these different departments take a couple of years to make. And I guess actually that might be a good launch point, because while you have worked on some very smaller, you know, grittier, tougher movies, you also have, you know, worked for movies at the big studios, and I would probably be beaten by one of our contributors at Podcast Them Softly, Joel Copling, if I bring up the fact that you worked on a Harry Potter film, which we know is Goblet of Fire, directed by Mike Newell. What was the experience like contributing to the Harry Potter universe, and were you a fan before, and have you, you know, did working on the film make you even more of a fan?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, I did a small, I worked in a small capacity on the second of that series for Chris Columbus. Oh. It turned out that I was unavailable actually to do the whole film because I'd committed to start on Dirty Pretty Things, as it turns out. So I had some time free before that actually started, and the editor who was available to do the whole of the second film for Chris, Peter Hoeness, a colleague and friend of mine, they said, well, Mick, will you step in for a couple of months and do a couple of sequences just so that we can keep ahead of things, which is what I did. So I thoroughly enjoyed that sort of short involvement. And then when I came back 2 years later to do the whole film, it was a great pleasure to kind of have ownership of the whole piece. And because, as we mentioned in our first discussion, that Mike Newell was a dear old friend of mine, it felt like a very a nice family to be a part of. Because those projects, certainly the one I did, they go on for quite some time. I was engaged to work on that for, I think it was 73 weeks, a year and a half, effectively, from beginning to end.
Wow, yeah.
So a year of which was actually shooting, and 6 months was post-production. So you can see how a big involvement it is, and you feel a bit lost when it suddenly one day it stops. In fact, I think I had a headache for a week.
Is that the longest post-production period that you've ever had on a movie?
Well, in fact, the post-production was only 6 months, but the shooting was a year. So it was the longest shoot period that I'd ever been involved with, while we're obviously editing alongside. But, yeah, in effect, as an engagement for a film, I think it was the longest, yeah. I would think, generally a year feels like that's a long... Everest was a year for me, I think, from top to tail, but... The Potter film was definitely the longest time I'd ever spent on one project, and I was flat out from the day I started to the day I finished. It's the nature of those things.
And in terms of a film like Harry Potter, where obviously you have you get a chance to cut all of these great actors and all these very very wonderful performances that made up all those films, but. In a film like that, you're working with a lot of CGI, a lot of images that might not be finished, maybe when they're passed off to you. I don't know how it works, the process, but what is it like cutting a special effects heavy film as compared to, something like Dirty Pretty Things, where it's, character and, and the scale and the scope is much more intimate?
Yeah, it's a very different... animal altogether. We call them, as it were, visual effects rather than special effects. Special effects tend to be things that you see on screen, like fire and rain and snow and all that stuff that's real.
That's the old school in me right there. The special blanket term, special effect, visual effect, CGI.
Visual effects, CGI. In fact, it's very difficult, and it promotes a very, very strict discipline in the production, because what we call the first stage of photography that will accept the visual material that's going to be added, the CG material that's to be added, has to be cut and budgeted for frame by frame. So you might have a sequence of 30 shots, of which 25 are to have, let's say, in the case of that film, a computer-generated dragon put into it. Okay. Now, that's going to take months of work to create that, and it has each of those shots has to be cut to the frame without this ingredient, because each frame is such a costly thing to produce. So, in effect, we have to cut blindfold, if you like, or with only one initial layer, and have to imagine the rest, which... in terms of film editing, where you're constantly adjusting lengths and angles and your patterns of cutting, can be very stressful, and it gives you sleepless nights. And generally, you tend to undervalue the shots because you can't see the visual contribution which is going to come, perhaps months later. I think there was one sequence in that film which I started when I arrived, and I was, completed when I left 18 months later. So... you're in for the long haul on those things. Now, sometimes adjustments are possible to a degree, but generally that's a cost and that's an expense which everybody would want to avoid. So you might be having to cut a sequence without these ingredients to lay down, if you like, the foundations upon which all the CG work will be added pretty much to the frame very quickly, and that's a nerve-wracking experience. And also remember, we're shooting out of order, so you don't know what the whole film feels like. I think we talked about it with Everest, where there was CG work to do with it, in that case, environments being up 29,000 feet on a mountain. So it's difficult because you're having to gauge something and assess the value of it and the way it's going to work without having that visual ingredient. Of course, on a film like Dirty Pretty Things, the photography is it. That's it. It's pretty much there. The image that you receive from shooting is there, and you can work with it immediately. With CG biased films, you've got to guess, and it may be many months before you start to see the sequence that you plan come into fruition and life. And often, as in my case, I think, wow, I've made some terrible errors of judgment here. How am I going to get out of that one? It gives you a sleepless night or two, I can assure you.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
Well, Mick, going back to the pre-CG days, was going to ask about your collaboration with Neil Jordan Interview with the Vampire.
Yeah.
And I guess is that the first Brad Pitt film you worked on?
It was indeed, yeah. And actually, interestingly, just to tie that into the visual effects world. That was only the visual effects side of movie making that we now know was only just beginning to come into being. And in that film, amazingly, we had real stunts. You know, we had a man, you know, climbing over the ceiling on fire, and he did that for real, you know. And there were stunts in the old traditional movie stunt tradition there, which, of course, nowadays I think would be, you know, done with CG. They wouldn't go to those sorts of lengths and risks and so on that we did then. But it was just, I think we had a few CG shots which were to do with, say, putting period boats into a harbour or whatever. I can't remember exactly, but it was very early days. And certainly I remember stunts, in particular fire in that film, which were done for real. I mean, they were extraordinary. And the stunt people used to come to my cutting room the next day and to check whether things were looking okay. And I'd meet these guys and say, "Are you crazy? You would do this for a living? Setting fire to yourself?" And they say, "Yep." and they were at their sort of admirable, extraordinary skills that people have and did. I'm sure there are many stunt people now that still do these things, but they would obviously, for time and motion reasons, I expect, always favour a CG solution, I imagine. I hope I'm relaying that correctly.
Can you shed any light on, this is a kind of a running thing in Neil's films, where he's always got a shot of a bridge.
Oh, is that
Did
right?
Did he discuss that? I don't know if he discussed that with you or not, but that's, it's in every one of his films.
That's interesting. I'll have to ask him next time. I haven't seen him for a while, but we certainly started with one of the most famous bridges of all time, you know, the Golden Gate. And amusingly, the first secret preview we had of that film, which was we were flown to LA and then on to a destination of which I even myself didn't know, to screen this film and to an audience that didn't know what they were going to see, to try it out. I think we certainly had Tom Cruise with us, Tom, and I think Brad was there as well. I can't remember. It was our first tryout in front of an audience of a very long cut of that film. And myself and other people involved in the editorial process were flown to a destination. We didn't really know where we were going until we found ourselves being driven over the Golden Gate Bridge. So we went up to somewhere near San Francisco to screen that film, ironically, which was a great privilege. I'd never been there. So Bridges figure. I don't know. I couldn't tell you what the theme is there. I have to ask Neil himself.
Yeah, I'm going to now have to go back and look at Neil Jordan's movies and try to find
bridges. Yeah.
Yeah, look for bridges now. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome. It's like Alfred Hitchcock running.
Is there a bridge in The Crying Game? I don't know. I can't.
There is.
Is there?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Every one of his films has a shot of a bridge. Yep.
Interesting. Okay. There must be some metaphor.
Yeah, I'm just curious what that was about. But yeah, we'll wait for you to report back to us.
I'm afraid I can't shed any light on that one. I can't shed any light on that. But
how involved was Neil in the editing suite?
Oh, very much. Yeah, no, we because Neil essentially had adapted Anne Rice's screenplay. He was very much there as a writer. Writer, director, and therefore editor. Oh no, very much. Yeah, it was good fun. And interestingly, we did something on that film which I have only utter admiration for David Geffen, who was our producer, who insisted on screening this early cut of the film in its entirety, which was very long. You know, it was a good two and three quarter hours long at that stage. We'd barely finished shooting, as I recollect. And David, much to my, at that time, horror, said, "Look, let's screen this whole thing because I want to find out what plays and what doesn't," which made me and my wife, who was also editing it with me, she worked as an editor as well for Neil. In fact, that's how I knew Neil, through my wife, Yoka. And we were cutting the film together, and we sort of were anxious about showing something that early. But David insisted on it and said, look, don't worry, on my head be it. And actually, it was a fantastic experience to feel that film, what played and what didn't. And then after that screening, that test screening, which again, you couldn't really do now because of the whole internet thing and people tweeting and talking about stuff, we went away and very quickly cut the film down by about 45 minutes. We knew, all of us, exactly what to do, and we completed the film very efficiently and swiftly. So thanks to David's bravado, I guess Neil was supportive of it. I can't remember, but I was rather thought, oh, can I have another month just to shape this up a bit? But he said, don't worry, it'll be fine. Let's just find out what we've got, and then we'll move from there. And it was a very, very solid thing to do.
Yeah, I've always, I'm not a big vampire horror person, but that is a movie that I grew up with. You know, I was in high school when that came out, and I remember it was all the rage. Everybody wanted to see it. I can still remember how lavish and lush that movie is on a visual side.
It was beautifully photographed by again an old friend of mine, Philippe Russolo, and the designer was Dante Ferretti. And together they created this extraordinary world. Again, being largely before CG, the sets were real. You know, they went way down the river. I remember seeing, wow, a mile and a half of set, thinking, goodness me, the scale of this thing is fantastic. Nowadays, you know, they'd only build, you know, a third of that and then add the rest as CG. But, no, it was lavish. My children who are now, my kids who are daughters who are now 25 and 28 still haven't seen the film. They say it's too scary.
and you know, and it has such an amazing cast. I mean, like, obviously Brad Pitt, you know, pre-big time stardom, like, just, you know, when he was really getting his feet wet with some of these roles, you know, year before Inception, and it sort of boggles the mind to think that Pitt and Cruise. Is that the only time that Pitt and Cruise have been in a movie together, right?
I think so. I'm not a sort of contemporary historian.
Yeah,
they've both done so much since. It probably is. I do remember though, because shortly afterwards, a little while afterwards, we made 12 Monkeys, and I knew Brad because of Vampire, and I remember seeing a trailer of his while we were shooting. Suddenly surrounded by crowds of people, and that had been the case with Tom, not Brad, on Vampire, and I thought, wow, it's happened, you know, he's really shot up, and then he never looked back. So it was that sort of hysteria suddenly was present, certainly in the Vampire cutting room. People would come to my cutting room door every day and say, oh, is Tom coming to see you, you know. They would hang around the cutting room door. And I'd have to lie and say, no, he doesn't come and see me, you know. But he was very involved. And all of those people were terribly involved and committed to that project and contributed more than their what is seen to be their individual role. So, again, it was a fantastic collaboration. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And when you look at your credits, you know, pre-Interview with the Vampire, obviously you had some period pieces. You had some films that were done on a large quote-unquote scale, but correct me if I'm wrong, would Interview with the Vampire been the biggest quote-unquote movie that you had a chance to cut up until that point in terms of a scope and in terms of all of the elements at play?
I think it probably was. I mean, Dangerous Liaisons, you know, obviously was a wonderful period piece, but it was more contained. And it was a considerably smaller budget, as I recollect. Vampire felt pretty big when we got into it. You know, we had shooting in New Orleans. We had a long time here in London in Pinewood. There was shooting in San Francisco. There was shooting in Paris. And this huge mega cast. I think it was probably probably the biggest thing I'd sort of stumbled upon at the time we did it.
I sort of want to just circle back to, you know, if it's not the very beginning, but the beginning enough, one of your first credits, at least the Internet Movie Database lists you as the editor of a version of King Lear. with a
date
of
1976.
And I wanted just to ask, I have not seen this, I have personally not seen this version of King Lear, but I would love to know what was it like for Mick Audsley to be cutting your first film, and how did you get that first job, and you know, given that it was King Lear, what was your response to, you know, working with such weighty material the first time?
That's a good question. Well, it was in fact pretty much the first film that I cut, and it was actually a filmed adaptation from a theatre company here in Britain. So it was like a staged theatre presentation out in a proper exterior in a slate quarry in the northwest of England in Wales, and it was for the British Film Institute. I think I talked a little bit about stumbling across being involved in the British Film Institute at that time, and I don't know quite how I managed to end up with that job, but I certainly presented to the director, who was a sweet guy called Steve Rumbelow, I think his name was, who accepted my authority as an editor when I, if truth be known, couldn't back it up. So I bluffed my way through, and in the process of cutting that film realized how little I knew. I was fortunate that at that period in the British Film Institute there were some very qualified and experienced editors who held my hand and would take me aside and instruct me on how it all worked. So I stumbled through, but I'm sure poor old Steve didn't realize how ignorant I was. But it gave me a taste for that job, and I mean, the Shakespearean English is what it was, and I had studied Lear at school, I think, so I had a sort of understanding of what was going on. But my understanding of film grammar and all the rest of it was pretty thin, but I bluffed my way through.
And
I think everybody starting out in a career has to do a certain amount of, I won't say lying, but a little avoidance of the truth. I certainly did.
When you were working on your first on King Lear, did you automatically or immediately have that feeling in your bones like, okay, I'm an editor, this is what I absolutely want to do, and I can see a career ahead of me, and like were you?
That's a good question. I definitely had I know this is a rather sickening phrase, but a light bulb moment where, in the process of starting that job, which I stumbled in, it was somebody else wasn't available. It was a rather a fluke, and feeling very ignorant of what the job was. But I definitely had a sort of overnight light bulb moment, realizing that this was what I wanted to do. Whether I would continue to, I wasn't at all sure. But I was desperately hungry the minute I got my fingers on this thing to learn and go forward, and I realized it was something I desperately wanted to do, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and not much changed over the years. So it was a sort of a signpost to I also needed to earn a living. There was that side of it too, and I thought, well, they seem to be wanting to ask me to do something else, so I'll carry on. I didn't know how long it would last, I'll be honest with you. I thought I didn't really have a future. It was going to be difficult, and it was, to survive announcing yourself. And I was quite young, actually, and to announce yourself as a film editor. But, I was helped greatly by people around me, people who I looked up to, took me under their wing and educated me, and I sort of fell in with the right people, the right people for me, and I'm forever grateful for that, to them and for that.
Mick, did you have a plan B in place?
Yeah, I think it was probably gardening or something.
I don't, something lucrative like gardening.
I think it's one of the truisms about youth is that you actually are not very knowledgeable, but youthful endeavor and vigor gets you through that bit by a bravado. Oh, I can do this. It's easy. oh, yeah, I can do this, no problem. And I certainly, that perhaps was my state of mind. It's only by doing it, the awful truth starts to emerge that you know nothing and you've got a lifetime ahead of you to learn it. And I guess that's what happened. But, you know, youthful and vigor and a certain amount of arrogance, I suppose, you soldier on. And by doing it, you find out how little you know and what you've got to learn and how you need to climb up the ladder and try and understand how films work and how they're made. And be greedy to absorb and come into contact with those people that can inform you or read what you can or see a lot of, you know, do whatever you can to enrich your abilities. And I certainly tried as hard as I could to do that.
Again, when you look at the credits that you've worked on, it's amazing because, you know, some of the films that you did work on, you know, some of these smaller ones, you know, in the 80s and 90s, you know, I look at them and I just say, God, I need to revisit this movie. And one of those movies is a film that I must have watched, I mean, probably 50 times on HBO when I was growing up, which is We're No Angels.
Yeah.
Another Neil Jordan film that you worked on with Robert De Niro, Sean Penn, Demi Moore, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Great cast in general. And one of the early De Niro comedies, you know, before he became, you know, Mr. Comedy, if you will, with, you know, Analyze This and Meet the Parents and all of the sort of character roles that he's taken on of late.
That's right. And beautifully written by, you know, no less than David Mamet, you know.
David Mamet, absolutely. And it's one of those great, like, misunderstanding comedies. You know, people are, you know, they're mistaken for someone that they're not. In this case, as I recall, they're convicts and they end up near Canada and there's an issue of them getting over the border and there's all this sort of shenanigans that are going on. And I just remember really enjoying it as a kid, and I really need to seek this one out and see it again. What can you remember from working on that film, and given that it was De Niro and Sean Penn, and what were the experiences?
Yeah, it was beautifully photographed by Philippe Rousselot, who I collaborated with on Dangerous Liaisons, and the writing, you know, David's writing and the structure of the thing was so strong that you were very safe in that with that structure underneath the editorial process. The issues that we had, which I think perhaps now could possibly handle better, was to understand with a comedic base like that what temperature the performances need to be to work best. You know, it's a difficult one for, I think, culturally too, between America and Britain. Perhaps we're more conservative, and perhaps in America at that time it felt that the performances needed to be a bit broader, you know, to really resonate for the audience. I don't know. I'm not sure whether we got the temperature of the performances exactly right all the way through. But they were wonderful players and, you know, so competent at what they do. It was fun, and it is great to work on something which is in effect lighthearted like that and full of whimsy. And has, in a way, it's just an escape story. It's a very simple narrative. They've got to get somewhere else to get away. But what's the matter with that?
No, absolutely. And you know, this sort of movie, you know, I had this conversation yesterday with a friend of mine. We were talking about how the middle of the road picture, not everybody needs to go to the movies every weekend to see either a $250 million CGI extravaganza or a film that's been made and released and designed to win Best Picture. And there's sort of this shrinking middle class of films that are, you know, in the 40 to, you know, the 30 to $75 million budget. I call them 1990s movies. films that aren't necessarily franchise pictures. They're not designed to sell lunchboxes, but they're designed to tell an entertaining story. And to sort of riff on genre. And
you enjoy it while you're watching it. It may not stay with you for life, but.
But it's a good film, and it's entertaining, and it's well made, and it's got some smarts to it. And again, it's not concerned with bowling you over every 3 seconds with some grand statement or some pretension for awards. And, you know, I'm hoping that more of those types of movies will find their way through the studio system in the coming years, because I just feel that there's this – I watch a movie from the 80s and 90s, and I say to myself, my God, okay. First off, they would never make this movie now for whatever reason.
If they
did try to make it now, it wouldn't be the same because the sensibility is so much different. And
That's so true. You touch on a very pertinent point here, I think. And I may have mentioned this before, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but shortly after we finished making 12 Monkeys, which was mid-90s, wasn't it? I ran into Chuck Roven, Charles Roven, who was the producer, and he said, you wouldn't believe this, but 6 months later, that film then wouldn't have been able to be made. You know, the climate had changed then by 6 months to prevent something as quirky as that being made. So goodness knows where we are now, 20 years on or 25 years on. So, yeah, the climate changes, and I'm not one to know how that all really works at all. For my own part, I just try and involve myself by choice in, because it's a lot of investment of your time and life, in things that you would want to see made yourself, that you care about, or you have an affinity or sensibility for as a person, you know, just taste, if you like. And so I try and involve myself with films that I think, well, I'd like to see that made, so I'd like to do it and help it get made.
Yeah, and your credits certainly speak to that mindset. I mean, you know, obviously there's things on your resume that you look at and you say, okay, he wanted to sample the goods here, and he wanted to, you know, branch out and try something there. But there is an honest through line to much of your credits that sort of, again, speaks to your desire to cut films that, impact you on a personal level, which I think is great.
It's just to do with the sensitivity. I mean, it's also, to be honest, you get known for a particular sort of perhaps sensitivity or affinity, let's put it that way. And if you're lucky, then it will continue along those lines. I haven't very often been offered something that I thought, oh, I just don't want to do that. You know, I've been generally offered things that I want to do, and it's actually schedules and so on which prevent you perhaps being able to take them, or just the practicalities of everyday life. But in general, I tend to be offered, and I feel privileged in that respect, things that are of my own sensibility, and therefore I probably you're going to be the right sort of person to be involved because you've got that affinity. And if you haven't, you shouldn't be there. I mean, look, we all have to earn a living, and there's families and livelihoods to be addressed. But if you're lucky to have a choice, it's definitely, you can't sort of fabricate interest and feign enthusiasm for a project, certainly in the editorial side of things. It's too long a commitment to feign it if you're not really genuinely involved and enthusiastic. I wouldn't like to be in that position where you're having to fake your involvement or your enthusiasm.
Sure.
That would be tough.
Nick, speaking of projects that I'm guessing really spoke to you personally. I know that you are a great lover of music,
and
you worked with Stephen Frears on High Fidelity.
Yeah.
You could talk a little bit about that experience,
yeah,
because that,
love that.
You know, such a love letter to rock and roll and just the love of music, among other things.
Well, that, you know, it is one of the happiest. It's a film I'm immensely proud to have been involved in. And, you know, the credit, of course, goes to a dream project, you know, the wonderful Nick Hornby and Nick's world that he sees, because that's at the root of it. Stephen did a wonderful job. Johnny Cusack and D.V. Vincentis and Steve Pink, those guys and the way they interpreted what was essentially seen as a very London story. And here at home in London, there was a certain amount of distaste originally when, rather brilliantly, it was set in Chicago, which to me seemed perfect because of it being, if you like, what we know globally as a musical city. And so the transposition from North London to Chicago was a brilliant maneuver. But what a joy. I mean, it was just a very funny film and beautifully done all round. And I still laugh. It's one of the few films that I've worked on myself, which I can look at and just enjoy as if I'm an outsider, because it just makes me hoot with laughter. It's because of its true, because it's about human experience and the truth. It's got a truth in it and a love of human beings in it, in a particular way. And that Nick's view of the world is so intoxicating. And the musical side of it is also terrific, because we all know about those truisms. Look, we had, you know, the emergence of Jack Black as a character who, at that time, I don't think Jack was really, I think he had to be sort of somewhat...
It was pretty early.
He had to be strong-armed into that part, you know, and then it became, if you like, his trademark, which he did brilliantly. I mean, it was just a joy from start to finish, and again, dealing with a comedic subject like that I found fascinating, because from an editorial point of view, the precision you have to administer to the timing of things is acute. Admittedly, with these guys, if you imitated what they were doing, generally that was, you were on it, because they had done it when they played it, rather than me editing it for that degree of precision. So it was just a joy. I thoroughly enjoyed every minute of that one too. It's great.
And it really is a film that resonated with so many people when it came out, and still does. And,
I think it will last. I think it will last. I mean, admittedly, the headache in that film, and I say that absolutely openly, was us clearing and all agreeing on what the music should be that was being played in the record shop, and getting the clearances. That was a long, ongoing process for us to all kind of be comfortable with what the music was, you know, in that world, in the record shop itself. And sure, thereby also the clearances and the legal side of licensing that material was a huge number. So the pictorial side of the film was made quite quickly, as I recollect, relatively quickly, that in the film. But the musical side was ongoing for quite some time.
And it's got a timeless feel. I mean, the movie is dated, you know, in terms of its musical selections, but they're timeless. The movie's dated in terms of the fact that it's a early aughts, you know, production, and it has that sort of sensibility, but yet it's timeless. And I it's been one of those films that I think has acted as like a comfort blanket for so many people, because it touches on...
I think you're right. I think that's very much to do with Nick Hornby's sort of deliciously, wonderful world that he sees and that we know is true, and he allows us into through his writing and his view of it. It's great, and it's the pain and the pleasure of it all.
Yeah, and it's really damn funny, and Catherine Zeta-Jones is just beyond gorgeous in that movie. I mean, it's like you can't believe it.
Yeah, and also it's so funny because she's such a sort of flawed character in the end, you know, the Charlie, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, it was a very, very collaborative venture again, with Johnny Cusack, and being in it and producing it and help and writing it with his other buddies, all good friends for many years. So it felt like a family affair, very much so. And it was a working title production, so for us it was old friends in that respect.
I think that we might want to sort of wrap our chat up with this question. And considering that you are a veteran editor, you've worked for years on films, and you've had a chance to watch a lot of movies. What are some of your favorite movies that you have not worked on in terms of the editing? What what movies have stood out to you, either because of the fact that they were invisibly edited, or maybe what are some of the best instances of sort of flashy, overt editing that's caught your eye?
Well, I never like to think of it as being something on the surface like that, although it may appear that way, you know, flashy or whatever, conspicuous. For me, it's whether the film communicates or engages you at all the levels that a good film can. Certainly I was very privileged at the time that we were making The Grifters, because our producer was Martin Scorsese and Thelma Shoemaker was involved, that Stephen Frears and I were invited to see an early cut of Goodfellas. They were just finishing it, or they were still cutting, I think. And we were invited to have a look at it because they had certain concerns about whether we would be able to absorb the voiceover and the vocal narrative. And so I was privileged to see an early cut of that film, and it completely blew my mind in every way. I just thought this was a giant of a film. And again, not just the editorial side, which is profoundly exciting and interesting and still is to me, but the whole density of that movie and the breadth of it, the subject it took on. So as a piece of, you know, that's a film which I think is a giant, as shocking as it is. But, you know, your relationship to these extraordinary people, however they choose to live, is very involved and very dense. So that's a huge piece of work for me. Going backwards in time, you know, similarly, equally, perhaps in a way, perhaps similar, that you care about people who are very complex and often morally very suspect. Bonnie and Clyde was always a wonderful, extraordinary experience. I'll never forget seeing that as a 16-year-old, 17-year-old for the first time. And I've seen it again recently, and it still blows my mind, you know. So the contributions from people like Dee Dee Allen on Bonnie and Clyde, or Thelma Shoemaker in Goodfellas, they do stand out. You know, there are many, many others' work which is extraordinary. I was lucky to share a platform with the wonderful Sylvia Ingsmardotter, who, you know, cut many, many of the films for Ingmar Bergman, and some of the work that she showed, which she had done, again, just absolutely flattened me, you know, as editorial work, just as filmmaking, let's put it that way. So yeah, I have these things that stand out for me. More contemporary stuff, I'm trying to think. Out there.
I have to be honest with you. You named my favorite film of all time. Goodfellas is my number one movie forever. Yeah, forever. So you're a hero now. Not that you weren't before, but you're even bigger.
It's interesting because part of our Sprocket Rock at Soho venture was I did a little a piece on suspense and tension. You know, we just take a kind of cinematic topic like that and try and with like-minded practitioners discuss in front of our little audience sequences or you know, how these things work. And one of them was, I'd forgotten about, from Goodfellas, a very simple sequence where, you know, De Niro is inviting Liotta's wife to buy this
garment.
Oh yes.
Yeah, you know the one, and sort of enticing her to go down the road, and you feel the sense of danger. It's done very simply, but it's a beautiful piece of filmmaking. If you watch it in isolation, even if you don't know what you know, you and I know, if you'd seen the whole film and all the tensions that creates, it's your anxiety in these few simple shots is exquisite, you know. And oddly enough, there's an interesting shot after she releases herself and jumps in the car. There's an even more terrifying shot where you see De Niro just sort of, it's a long shot, I think, just goes back inside, and you think, oh my God, there's worse to come.
He's like pissed. He's pissed off that she didn't walk down there.
That's right.
That moment takes your breath away, because Goodfellas, again, one of the so many things about Goodfellas that I find just absolutely masterful is that it's a film that makes you care 1 minute about absolutely violent, disgusting people who you
yes.
never should care about, and then
absolutely.
2 seconds later you hate them, and then a minute later you feel bad for them, and a minute later you're laughing with them,
absolutely.
And then a minute later they got a bullet in their head and you're upset. And, you know, I saw Goodfellas when I was like 14 or 15, right when I was a real big budding movie fan, and I was pissed off when Pesci got killed. I mean, like, I just was so upset. And I look back at it now, and I said to myself, why were you upset? The guy's a lunatic. He deserved to get
yeah.
shot. But that's the thing that's so brilliant about Scorsese and the way he manipulates
well,
the viewer in
yeah.
cinema.
Absolutely. And if you think, actually, now you've touched upon it, it makes me think that, you know, discussing Scorsese's work, if you think of Raging Bull, in a way is a film about a monster, but you understand him as a human being by the end. Now that's an incredible achievement for what he is, you know, and what he was. So yeah, it's that, and it's their use of the grammar of the film and the way in which he can manipulate you on a dime, you know.
Absolutely.
That to me is cinema, and there's nothing like it anywhere else, really. You know, theatre certainly for me, doesn't quite do it in that way. You know, but cinema, when it works, can be an extraordinarily, extraordinarily powerful tool, you know, to create this complexity of narrative. And, you know, I remember coming out of that film when we saw The Rough Cut, and they said, "What do you think?" And I was speechless. I mean, literally couldn't open my mouth. You know, I said, "It's the one most wonderful thing I've seen." Yeah,
absolutely.
Very complex. I mean, and equates to the density of a great novel or whatever, you know, that, for me, anyway.
Well, we got to say thank you very much again. You know, we
oh,
can
no
chuck
problem.
With, I'm sure, multiple hours, but this has been a real treat. And everybody, if you haven't seen Allied yet, go check it out. It's in theaters. And Mick, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. And hopefully you'll have another movie coming out soon, and we'll see your name up on the big screen shortly.
Yeah, I've started a new project in about 3 weeks' time. So
awesome.
It should be an interesting one. And I'll write and tell you all about it when it's all signed and sealed. But Tim and Nick, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to be a part of this, and what a treat it is to get together and talk about cinema.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours. We really appreciate your time, Mick.
All right, keep in touch.
You will,
do.
Mick. Thanks a lot.
All the best. Bye-bye now.
Bye now.